My name is Kevin Murphy, and this is the Mission Innovation Podcast.
My father taught me very, very early a hugely powerful lesson that the enemy is not poverty. The enemy is hopelessness.
Angela Blanchard, President Emerita of Baker Ripley, is a globally recognized expert practitioner in community development, disaster recovery, and effective long-term integration for immigrants and refugees. Angela's breakthrough strategies have not only successfully revitalized neighborhoods in her Houston community, but are providing a powerful model for cities across the globe facing the complex challenges of community transformation. She has received three invitations to the White House and has been profiled in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, Fast Company, CNN, NPR, and the Associated Press. It is her genuine reverence for people and her unique ability to bring them together in unprecedented ways that has played a pivotal role in the growth and impact of Baker Ripley. Her innovative strength-based framework, appreciative community building, has set the new standard for integrating diverse populations into thriving communities. Angela is a visionary leader for evolutionary change, and I am pleased to have her with us as our guest on this episode. Angela, what were the family lessons that were brought forward into the work that you do?
Family life lessons are very much on my mind right now. I'm writing about disasters and storms and how people rebuild their lives after upheaval. My origin story around upheaval begins in my roots as a Cajun person, a descendant from the Acadians who were deported from a peaceful settlement in Canada to what was then the Louisiana Purchase. And so embedded in the culture I come from, two things. One is a sense of healthy skepticism about officialdom. And the second is a heavy and intense belief in and reliance upon community. So those are sort of in the genes kind of inheritances. But in my immediate family of origin, you know, I had two parents who had eight children before they were 30. And I was the oldest and had responsibility from a very young age. And we really struggled in all the ways you would expect two parents who had themselves come up with very little. My father growing up in an orphanage and my mother growing up in seriously dire circumstances. And I watched us all figure out how to make our way in the world, how to build a business inside of our home, how to use what everyone could contribute. A simple and really delightful memory I have is my parents and this printing business that was started in our home. And you know, needing a collating machine, we didn't have one. And so here we were, all of us, with our freshly washed hands lined up, walking round and round the kitchen table. We were the collating machine for a printing job that my parents had done. So we grew up with this sense of people work together, people play together, people struggle together. And also this strong ethic of integrity around work. And that was a big shaper and a kind of a belief in that what we used to think of as an American dream, but I think of now as just the human dream of being able to foster and create and develop something of value that the world will pay you for. And so you have a place in the world. I think we learned early. My father taught me very, very early a hugely powerful lesson that the enemy is not poverty. The enemy is hopelessness. And when we can't see that our own efforts can make a difference or improve our life circumstances, it creates a kind of isolation and despair that's very expensive. So I felt early on this sense of determination to do everything possible to arrange the world so people's own efforts could pay off and their own hunger to earn, to learn, to belong, that those hungers could be satisfied.
What was your experience growing up in your community with how people may have treated you, responded to you, given your circumstances as a family?
Okay, some of it's just funny because actually as a huge part of the Cajun culture is the ability to laugh at things that are both sad and tragic, and humor plus tragedy, you know, that's pretty much, that's how you know you're alive and breathing. So for us, some of the funniest things is, you know, my parents were obviously young, you know, here they were with all these kids trailing behind them at the grocery store, wherever we went. People would sometimes look at us and then look away with this expression on their faces of just eye rolling disgust. And then, you know, of course, when we traveled in a station wagon where the seats all folded down, and we would leave early, often to see relatives in Louisiana. We'd be rolled up in our blankets like little sausages in the back. And it wasn't really uncommon for people to just stop and count us. I don't know what the purpose of that little inventory was, but there was definitely, this beaming disapproval in our direction. And then honestly, you know, there's no possible way to get 8 children, you know, spread over about 11 years to behave themselves. So we were, you know, we got the message that we weren't quite measuring up.
What was the impact of that message?
My first encounter with people like my family showing up in a textbook was rather horrifying. I was reading through a case study in a social work textbook. And it basically described my family, but it did so in these terms that were just filled with judgment and filled with a voice of doom, saying, look at this, how could this possibly turn out well? And I remember reading it and then feeling just so disturbed. I put my hand over the page because I had this feeling like, what if my mother saw this? What if my father saw this? I didn't want them to know that anybody thought of us this way. And for me, getting educated about poor people and poor communities and dysfunctional families and all these things, that labels that people had, it was literally a course in, you know, what was wrong with how I grew up. And so I knew then there needed to be some buffer, some filter between the way people who studied us thought about us and then the way we were helped. Because to have that kind of structure imposed on our families like ours and communities really was just demoralizing. I was on a search and in a moment of just complete sort of frustration and anger, I said to a colleague, there must be a way of studying people and communities that is not based on what's wrong with them. There has to be some way we examine the way people live and interact with one another for clues about how to support and help them, that is not the foundation of which is not a judgment about how they messed up. So, and he said, lucky me, he said, well, there's something called appreciative inquiry. I think is exactly what you're looking for. So the minute I began reading about it, I said, this is it. This is actually a method, but it's also got values based in it and beliefs based in it that are more consistent with mine than the beliefs that I felt were underlying the ideas I saw in many books and publications and in the professions and helping systems themselves.
For our listeners, what is appreciative inquiry? What is it?
Well, all full credit to David Cooperrider, and please go online and look up the good work that he did initially, and the good work being done still at Case Western, where this was birthed. But appreciative inquiry, the way I think of it, and don't take this as the gospel. The appreciative inquiry, as I think of it, is really the art of creating an asking questions that get at the heart of what gives life and energy and strength to community. So in the case of my work through neighborhood centers, now known as Baker Ripley, the key innovation was not the development of appreciative inquiry. It was marrying appreciative inquiry to an asset-based approach, the Kretzmann and McKnight approach, which is well documented from 70s on in terms of community development, saying we're going to take this methodology for asking questions, and we're going to be rigorous in our study and our examination of communities that we're working with. We're going to use this asset-based approach, linking those together for our thinking, for our planning, for our work, for our development work, wherever that leads, based on the aspirations of the community. So these were not new ideas. These were ideas, though, as I began with this approach, that I saw had only been, in many cases, experimented with. They had been used in a small fashion, for example, to craft a questionnaire in a program or as the foundation for some particular activity and so forth. But our determination was to do this at some scale and be relentless and be as fiercely determined in that approach as as had been the case with the other deficit-based and more critical approaches. So we began swimming upstream, and we did so for a very long time.
So it became a tool for you that you used as a foundational tool.
It's more than a tool. It's a way of seeing the world. It's a way of seeing the world based on the belief that there are strengths and resources and assets in every community, that there are leaders that we need for change in that community are already there. And then the further innovation for us was to allow that, what we uncovered in the way of strengths and resources and assets and the story at the heart of the community of what gave it life and energy, to let all of that drive investment. So, in the community development sector, we can spend a lot of time on development and engagement. We can spend even meaningful and we can work with integrity to capture the story, to capture these strengths and assets, and to really document the aspirations of the community, unearthing what's already working. If we do all that, but then the financial and other kinds of investments don't follow that, then that just creates an additional kind of level of frustration. And we had seen many instances in which developers of one kind or another would come to a community and say, oh, we want to understand what's great about this community and so forth. And they would put that on paper, but it never got off paper and into the ground. So we wanted our research into the strengths and resources and to aspirations to drive investment, to shape program design. So what came out of the ground was a physical manifestation. We say a community center essentially is a monument to the aspirations of community. It should be a physical expression of those and be recognizable to the community once created, once built. And the same can be said if you're building a clinic or you're building housing. All of that should look and feel by the time it appears familiar, as if it were born literally out of those aspirations. So that is a kind of faithfulness to appreciative inquiry and asset-based approaches that isn't as common as I would like for it to be.
It reminds me of your famous quote within your TED Talk that you can't build on broken.
Yeah, we certainly have tried that for a really, really, really long time. We've exhausted ourselves. We've worn out. We've actually imposed additional burdens of an additional work on people already who already have quite a lot to think about. I think that You Can't Build on Broken came from watching as I saw programs designed out of that deficit thinking. They were designed from the research that people did to unearth what was not working, to study the ways in which, for example, people weren't adhering to protocols for addressing their chronic health needs, to study, for example, why people weren't accessing training, to look at, you know, the school attendance and look at those students that were not attending and understanding why weren't they attending. So all of this starting from what do we want people to be doing? Why aren't they doing it? So, and then we would say, well, they're not doing it because of this, because of that, and which would lead to another set of problems that we would then go off and explore. And I felt at times that I had spent many hours in meetings where people put the problem at the center of the table and worshiped it and built careers off of studying it, picking apart people and families and communities to be more and more precise about how they weren't measuring up. It just leaves me almost just speechless with frustration because it leads nowhere. When we work instead with a real faith and commitment to understanding what does work in that community, what people have crafted for themselves that is providing sustenance and support and energy, when we will be relentlessly focused on that and the way we might formally have examined the problems, then we see the door open to all kinds of possibilities that don't exist with the other approach. So I sum that up. You can't build on broken.
Let's develop that a bit more. When you go into a community, when you partner with a community, what are the principles and approach you take towards supporting and serving there?
So first, it starts with where do we go? We go where we're invited and we do what we're asked to do. So obviously now that those requests come from people who have seen our work. And as I say, Baker Ripley, we work in Texas and learn and teach everywhere. So I think the starting place is, are you invited? Because when we show up like the Savior here to transform the community, it's really a form of colonizing. So we pay attention to the invitations we get that stem from people having seen work in other communities. And then the request is often, Kevin, going to start with, we'd like a community center, because that is, again, the visible manifestation of our work, a 5-building, 4-acre site, or a town hall, a town center that we're building now. So people see that and say, well, we need something like that. And then we gently say, you know, first we build community, then we build the center. So the work really begins with saying, what is it that's working here? It's interviews, it's individual interviews, it's group discussions, and we're logging all of that in. We're taping it. We're fancier now, so we have a tool that we can run it through that looks for repetition of themes and common words and language that the whole community is using to describe an experience of coming together or to describe an aspiration that they all share. When we say we know we have the story, when we're starting to hear like a tune that you're very familiar with, when people begin to talk, you say you could hum along with them. And so we do it to that point. And sometimes that means a couple of hundred interviews. And it's saying to someone, tell me about a time when you were really challenged in your business. You were struggling with a problem with your child. You couldn't figure out how to work with the school. Who did you go to? Who was most helpful to you? Tell us what they did. How were they helpful to you? And then we might go to that person and say, oh, we understand that, you know, you helped your neighbor when they were trying to figure out their business. In fact, they said you loaned them the money to open the second shop. You know, what made you do that? How do you know how to do that? What more would you like to learn about that? Where would you like to see that go? Who else have you helped? So we're building both a visual map of how people are already related and connected and supporting one another in that community. At the same time, refining the words and the tune to the sound of what that community, that story in that community. And that's when we then publish that. We publish it back to the community first, saying, here's what we saw and heard. We have, you know, we have slides and we have paper and we do it in big rooms and we say, this is you as you've told us your story. And make sure that everyone in the room, sometimes it's 300 or 400 people, saying, yeah, that's it. You got it. And then that is what we share with the larger community. One of the most profound shifts that occurs from this way of working. In the old way, there was a story you told about the community, and it was not the story you told to the community. You left the community and you told the story of need and lacks and gaps and problems and issues in dire circumstances. And it was awkward if you were telling that story in front of these people because we didn't actually, for us, because we didn't really see them that way. So now we're leaving the community with a story about the community that represents them the way they see themselves to people who might want to invest in their potential. And it's quite wonderful to have one story that you tell 360 degrees everywhere you go. That congruence is powerful. And you can shorten all that. You know, don't say anything about people you wouldn't say in front of them. Simple.
Right. What are some of the more inspiring stories that you've experienced when you've walked into communities and done this work?
I think what inspires me most is seeing the power that comes with being listened to. So when we have people in this one community near Houston, for example, in Pasadena, talking to us about their concerns about a non-responsive school district. So we're not trying to shift their concerns. We're not telling them that they need to do something different. We're listening carefully and saying, you know, what is it you'd like to see change here? What would be different if the school worked the way it should? It's using appreciative inquiry, even when there are really deep-seated problems, when there's a perception, for example, that this school district has ignored the voices of Latino parents, even though it's a predominantly Latino community. So we talk about, you know, so what is it, what would bring about this change? What would it take? Who makes these decisions? What would make this different? And they're led themselves to the answers of, I need to run for school board. And then it becomes, how do we do that? First, how do we speak to school board? Wow, they did really listen the way we hoped. How do we run for school board? And then it becomes a community prepared to challenge the way elections in Pasadena are held so that they can fairly run for school board and city council and other positions. And we've seen that. That's, for me, I don't actually like the word empowerment very much. What I really like is to see people awaken to their power and then to be side by side with them as they discover how to use it. And, you know, amongst these struggling communities, here are people that know have faced many obstacles in their life. Time. So when they run headlong into a school board that doesn't listen, and then they run into challenge trying to run for that school board, and they run into a challenge trying to challenge the reasons they can't be fairly elected, you know, that's pretty inspiring to watch. That's a kind of determination that is true leadership. So what gets led gets done.
I like that statement. What gets led gets done. Are there other stories, Angela, that have been formative for you?
The stories that have really, for the last decade, shaped my thinking most profoundly are the stories that have come out of profound disasters. So disaster can strike at any moment. If you're an adult, you've probably lived already through something that was threatening in some way to something you deeply cared about. And maybe you've had a profound loss of one kind or another, a loved one, a community. It could have been a fire. It could have been a flood. It could have been a financial disaster. So we live with this vulnerability, this notion that at any moment, it could all be taken away. So I became very, very riveted, very focused on studying now what. So it's all been taken away. You're looking at a blank sheet of paper. You're in a shelter holding a t-shirt and a photograph, and that's all that's left of your life. Studying how people go on, not only go on in some sort of resigned way, but actually recreate lives out of their imagination, recreate work out of their motivation, recreate connection out of their love for one another and for community, watching what they do, what they prioritize, what they build first after a storm or a fire. All of that has been enormously inspiring to me. And I feel in some way has given me a window. It's been a real privilege to work with these hard hit communities because it's given me a very profound window into what matters most and what we're like when we're at our purest, our most human. Essentially, this is a journey in many ways. It's a spiritual journey that largely is a manifestation at each step of our beliefs about life and meaning and purpose. So it's been a really remarkable thing to be witness to it, to be a participant. Also, I have to say, when I talk about there's not a hurricane or a storm on the Gulf Coast that I could talk about and not tell you a person that I care about that was impacted directly by that storm. And watching, you know, for example, my brother, you know, to clean out his house after Hurricane Ike brought 8 feet of water into his home. A little clue, whatever we send out all the time, ignore, deny, repress, when we have a catastrophe, it's all washing up again, right? So Mother Nature brings us back everything we send out in a storm and reminds us of a lot of things we haven't addressed. But to see, you know, essentially how people recreate their lives, recreate their connections, what gets prioritized for investment is a good indication of what matters most to us. And I think it inspires me because one thing I've lost count of the number of upheavals I've been a part of in some way, but in every one, the generosity of the human spirit is absolutely reliable. It's absolutely, utterly reliable. Anyone going into an arena after disaster needs to be thinking how to capture it, how to direct it, how really to apply it, because it will show up. As you know, I was responsible for setting up and operating a mass shelter during Harvey, quite frankly. And, you know, the one unmanageable part in the first 3 days, the one thing that completely got away from me over and over again was the entrance for volunteers, the place where people who wanted to help those that had been made homeless, that got overrun. And we had lines that were longer for helpers than those that were trying to get shelter.
I find it fascinating, given the number of disasters you have been present at to serve, that you connect it to a spiritual journey as well.
So let me just take you back to a personal story where I started with hurricanes and being Cajun. We grew up with hurricanes. We loved hurricanes. The water came in, it made a mess, the water went out. So then Katrina happened, and the levees failed, and the water came in, and it came in, and it came in. It did not go out. And all of the world as we had known it about how help comes or doesn't was reshaped by Katrina. In my mind, there's a before Katrina and after Katrina. And then there was, you know, Rita and Ike, not too far on the heels. And then we had a stretch where we said, not too bad. We just had a lot of flooding. The water came in, the water went out. And then Harvey. So the water's not going anywhere. The water's rising. And I am heartened in one respect to hear people in Houston talk about living with water, rebuilding for water, in consideration of water, in recognition of water. And so that we are going to do, I think. It will not stop flooding, disruption, and upheaval. The pattern of inflows of people to cities as a result of war or weather, loss of health or wealth, flows of people in need of seeking higher ground and wanting to be pulled ashore, those are going to continue. That's a worldwide pattern. And I feel strongly that community development in the next couple of decades is largely going to be about fostering these landing places in communities and on-ramps so that people arriving can be welcomed and can have access to opportunities to earn, learn, and belong in the new community in which they all find themselves.
For next generation leaders, Angela, who want to be involved in community development, what would your advice be to them?
So first, be prepared to improvise. When you go to an improvisation theater, they feed off of what's in the room. They use what's available. Their answers and their what they create is based on an and, not a but. So what can we do with what we have, where we are right now? That's number one. Be a good improviser. Number two, be a true student of the resources and strengths and assets in any arena. So I've talked about that in a community, in a neighborhood, but what allowed us to act effectively to help and save one another in this region was a real grasp of the strengths of this community. What could we count on? What could we call on? Who's good at what? Even in the answering the request for setting up the shelter, I was answering that request fully aware of who of my teammates was going to be best at what aspects of this undertaking, which was really, it was an intense and swift need to respond. And it was our knowledge of one another and where we were great that allowed us to come together and perform. So second is a strength-based, resource-based examination of your surroundings. And then I think that third thing is all about relationships. Elizabeth Dole said this when she led the Red Cross, the time to build relationships is not 2 a.m. and when the hurricane's in the Gulf. So when we need to move and accomplish things as leaders, we can only move at the speed of trust. And trust is built out of personal and professional connections. This mutual appreciation, an understanding we have with one another that we're in this together, and that likely what we'll face will call upon us to exceed the standard routine nature of our work, and that based on that trust, we will do so. So when I got the call saying, will you stand up this shelter? It was my trust of the person making that call, my understanding of his intentions as mirroring mine, wanting only what was best for our region, wanting to make sure that no one in our community felt abandoned, knowing that he and I shared that, meant that I could say yes in an unconditional way, because leadership is not about, it's not about accomplishing what has a guaranteed chance of success or what you're confident you can do. That doesn't require leadership. That requires good management. Good management is accomplishing what you're pretty sure you can do. Applying resources to a known situation, to a goal. Leaders are the people willing to commit to something when there's no guarantee of success. And those relationships help us commit to one another in the pursuit of something that's necessary, but is not already mapped. So I think the fourth thing is that we live in a time, we're facing a time of upheaval. And these upheavals will displace people. And the art of welcome, whether it's the welcome to your faith community, the welcome to your workplace, or the welcome to your neighborhood, deep practicing of welcome with all of its rituals of food and sharing and all of that, that's worthy. You will find that you will want to be on the receiving end of it, and you will also want to be good at offering it.
For those next generation leaders, what would you point to as experiences that are causing you to have hope today?
So Okay, first, I want to be really clear. Hope for me is a choice, and it's different than an expectation. So I know that when I'm in a spirit of hopefulness, because if things don't go as I would like, I'm not bitter and resentful, because I'm not entitled for the world to turn out the way I think it should. What gives me hope now, where I see great promise and energy amongst young people, what is thrilling to me is that they are terrific improvisers. It's almost like having witnessed the way in which our safety, security, predictability, our routine, our structures, and our systems didn't respond or couldn't move at the speed of need. Having seen that, they are totally willing to experiment. One of the great things about this whole next generation of leaders is if they're willing to go get an idea in the morning and try it in the afternoon. And I think that's actually very, very healthy right now. I think as they grow into leadership roles, they're going to be challenged to make more and more of an effort to capture what they learn from that constant experimentation. I see them seeking community and trying to understand how community is created when they live always in two places, one on the ground and one online. So they live online and they live on the ground. And I think they're going to craft, and already are, a relationship between those two things that's livable and healthy from the human standpoint. So those are promising things to me. I mean, one small example out of the hurricane, and I talked to this younger leader the other day who saw an incredibly important need is how do we identify those homes in need of repair so that we can harness that generosity that shows up each time and deploy teams to those homes in a not swiftly, efficiently, prepared for what they're going to find when they get there. So those solutions that kind of tie the human spirit and the information needed to aim it, those solutions are going to come out of this next generation of leaders. They don't wander, as in WANDR, and they don't have to wonder, WONDER. Both wander and wondering, those have been, they're developing good technological solutions for those. So there's more delivery, less wondering and wandering.
You've reminded me of a quote by Vaclav Havel around hope. He says, hope's not the expectation that things will turn out well. Hope is the expectation that there's meaning no matter how things turn out.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. And we're here. We're already, all of us are just a giant experiment. So we should all be maintain what Cajuns call a big curious. A big curious is how will this turn out? What will happen? How will we make meaning? And how will we be in this together?
As we're nearing the end of our conversation, Angela, I'm wondering if you have a favorite poem that you might leave us with.
I have many favorite poems, but one of my most favorite is a poem called Storm Warnings, and it's an Adrienne Rich poem. And I like it because it speaks to, but the storm is, one feels mostly metaphor in the poem, but it does speak to the understanding that we are not controllers of what happens, but what we can do in the face of when the wind rises, so to speak. I love the lines, between foreseeing and averting change lies all the mastery of elements which clocks and weather glasses cannot alter. Time in the hand is not control of time, nor shattered fragments of an instrument a proof against the wind. The wind will rise. We can only close the shutters. I just find that beautiful.
Today, our conversation with Angela Blanchard has offered us another example of mission innovation. Resources mentioned during the podcast are posted with this episode on our website at missiononline.net. Appreciation to Angela Blanchard and our listeners. Thanks, everyone. I'm Kevin Murphy. This is the Mission Innovation Podcast.